So, Joe, your life has been up and down and all over the place. But just chronologically, take me through your army years. For 9 years with the British Army, where were you stationed? Where did you
Well,
go?
first of all, I went to Farnborough in England, which was the Royal Engineers recruitment centre, right under the right next to the aircraft testing area. And after doing 14 weeks of infantry training, I moved on to the clerical course. And unknown to us on the clerical course, a decision had been made that the top six on the clerical course would be posted to headquarters or embassies throughout the world, British embassies, because the movement control clerk, your training is to be able to move troops from A to B, and that included single people, single units coming home for compassionate leave and things like that, as well as large movements. And I came somewhere in that top six. Now, this is the one thing I found all through my army career, that if I'd been a British officer looking at those top six, and to take the headquarters job or embassy job, you had to be cleared to handle top secret material because of where you were going. I would have moved my name to number 7 or 8.
Why would you do that?
Because I came from the Republic of Ireland. I was going to be harder to check than a guy coming from the middle of England. But instead of that, they assigned me to one of these six jobs. And I spent 5 months from January 59 to June, July 59, staying and holding camps in England while MI6 checked out my background and actually came over here and interviewed me there and checked me out before I was cleared.
Because this was in the 50s, and things were fairly rough at home
Yeah,
here.
and if you also remember, this was the period when all the spies were being found in the British establishment and the American establishment.
Well, they found nothing in your background anyway
Yeah.
to upset you.
And then I moved to headquarters, British Army of the Rhine in Rheindahlen in Germany.
Well, now we were in NATO, weren't we, at this
Yes.
stage?
And I came home. I got permission to get married because I was under 21. I had to get a letter from my commanding officer, and my father had to write to him to say he was allowing me to marry because I was under 21. Came home, got married, and my wife joined me in Rheindahlen in private accommodation. We lived as civilians in the German towns around Rheindahlen. And I spent a year and a half there as a movement control clerk, but on war planning. And the thing was that an ordinary soldier very rarely sees officers above the rank of major. I never saw officers below the rank of captain because they were all staff officers. And my immediate officer above me was a brigadier. And
How exciting was this for
it
you?
was exciting in a way that you got great. I remember an Australian major coming in and saying to me, the thing was, no, people give out about being called Paddy or anything like that. I never did, because officers, including the brigadier, used to come in and say to me, "Good morning, Paddy," and the sergeant be sitting next to me and he'd say, "Good morning, Sergeant so and so," but he never used my rank. And my wife got friendly with an officer's wife, and I used to go, my own officer, Major Holland, and I used to go out. I'd be sitting there, and he'd come in to me from his office, and he'd say, "Paddy, you're coming home with me. Tayus is up with Mary."
Were you regarded then as kind of just a second class soldier, or were you
Not so much because of that link. Yes, soldiers were in second class, But because of that link, I got to show them that I was slightly different. I was better educated. I was older. Although I was only 19, 20, the rest, except the sergeants, and they were, but the privates and lance corporals and corporals were...
Don't tell me, they were only teenagers.
They were only national servicemen, 18.
Oh. Well, okay, now... What was your brief, and what did you do from there on?
Well, then I was moved. After 18 months, I got posted as a full corporal, which is a rank I never got higher than, up to NATO. And I became a movement control clerk in G4 movements in HQ NORTHAG, Northern Army Group, where under me I had a Belgian private. Over me, I had a German sergeant. In the office, I had a Dutch, a British, and a Canadian major. The half colonel was German, and the general was English.
All different nationalities.
All different nationalities. And, you know, you got into the habit, like, I can't speak French or German. Well, I can a few words of German. But you got it that the Belgian officer would say something to you in French, and you automatically worked out what he was saying.
Were you aware of what was going on military in the world at that stage?
Yeah. The department I was in were drawing up the plans. That at the time we were, for instance, I was there during the Bay of Pigs, and after it, I was there during the Cuba crisis. And the Cuba crisis is the nearest we got to war while I was there in NORTHAG. Because what they thought was that if Kennedy had stopped the Russian freighters coming into Cuba, the Russians would have taken over the whole of Berlin, because Berlin was a free zone, half of Berlin was. So you had to travel through Russian lines to get to Berlin. And what our job was, we planned the move of any regiment in the Northern Army Group, from their peacetime location to the war location, on paper.
On paper?
Yeah.
We
knew where they were going. Now, I did, say a tank regiment, the only other person that'd know it in that regiment most probably was the officer commanding. The officers under him wouldn't know it. And I ended up with cosmic top secret clearance, commander-in-chief eyes only. If my general went to a meeting and he needed files from our office, I sat behind him with the files on my lap. Now, I didn't take part in the meeting anyway, but we're there.
And you were in the middle of all this, and you saw exactly the procedure, what was taking place. Yeah. What was the mood of the people who knew at the time? I mean, were they aware?
You were very apprehensive, I suppose. But, I mean, it was your job and you lived with it.
We were heading towards nuclear war.
Yeah, and all the time I was in Northern Army Group, every summer, a team of Territorial Army people used to come out and join us in the office and see what we were doing. They wouldn't get to know exactly the papers, but what we worked at. Because we had a 100% casualty job in the outbreak of war. Because it was thought that the Russians would use low-yield nuclear weapons to take out the regiments in Western Germany.
And this would have been mass destruction, bombing going on. And it was your brief to...
That I had Territorial Army corporal who knew my job to a certain extent, not the full papers in it. And he would have been mobilized and shipped out to take over in the first week of war, because we would have been, we were on paper now this, we, it was accepted that we were casualties.
Casualties?
Yeah, total casualties.
And you were quite happy, not happy, but you were quite content, were you?
Well, you did it. It was your job. I mean, I was content.
Were you scared?
No, I don't think so. I was content that I was doing a clerical job. I got a terrific training as a clerk. I was in the British Army for 9 years. Every year in that 9 years, Britain was fighting a small war somewhere in the world. Cyprus, Aden.
The Falklands.
No, the Falklands way later. But, you know, little Borneo, Burma, and there were soldiers being killed. But I never heard a shot fired in anger in my 9 years in the British Army. So, I mean, you looked at what you wear and what you're doing. I had a fabulous life. I was living in Germany. I eventually got married quarters in Dusseldorf, and we were going down to Dusseldorf to the nightlife at Dusseldorf. My children were all born in Germany, and my wife was with me all the time, and we had a good life.
And it just lasted for 9 years.
I have a sort of a stepson. And he's out in Kosovo at the moment, unbombed, I suppose.
Yeah, and the condition or the
and in the Irish Army now.
Terrible. Yeah, in the Irish Army.
And he.
So the traditions as well continue in the family.
You just.
Yeah. You're just born into it.
And you're not born into it. It was just a job to me.
Yeah, but. A little of it was passed down to you, of course, but your uncles and your father and your
Well, I suppose that, but I mean, we were... I wouldn't have thought I would... My father had no background of military. My grandfather had no background of military. But, it's...
How close were we to pressing the red button?
We were with about 2 degrees below it. In that time, and when you read now, only for a German submarine commander, a Russian submarine commander, would have happened, because he had instructions that they were coming in around the freighters going to Cuba, and the American warships were out circling in international waters around Cuba. And they were harassing each other. And the Russians had instructions that if they were rammed by a warship, they were to fire. And that would have started the war. And this, it's come out now on the History Channel or somewhere, I saw it, not so long ago, that an American warship actually bumped, didn't ram, but bumped a Russian submarine, a nuclear submarine.
And
the commander disobeyed orders and didn't fire. He reckoned that it was an accident.
Where you were sitting at that stage was in you were in administration in Berlin. You were sitting down.
We packed the boxes ready to go out. There was a coal mine, which was our deployment area, and we were to go down this coal mine and live down there, or try and survive down there if the nuclear attacks had started.
And you were all ready to go?
We were in about 48 hours of going to that. We'd started packing up and getting things ready to go on the trucks.
How many of you, roughly, were going to go down into those?
Well, there was thousands in that headquarters. It's a huge headquarters. It was built at the end of the war, and it was built that if... Because, I mean, at the end of the war, it was thought that the occupation troops would eventually move out totally, And it was built as a hospital. It's laid out like a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But
and I was there a sigh of relief when?
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't think as much as Kennedy as other people here in Ireland. He got a little bit too slap happy for my liking at that time.
What, just to move on a little bit, do you remember the Berlin Wall coming down? Were you?
No, I was out of the army. I was back here then. That's only right. Recent.
Yeah. Where did you go when you left the army 9 years later?
Well, in the army, I went for 2 years in Bahrain, and then I came back and did a last year and a half in Bielefeld. What they do, they give you a break. You know, if you've been doing the movement control job, your next job is different. So they sent me out to work services in Bahrain. And I was involved with the building of the barracks for the Emirate forces. The states, the Emirates were under British protection at the time. They were they hadn't got their independence anyway, but they were going to get it, and the British were building the barracks for them, and I was on the clerk on the planning of those and the work service side of it. And then I came back and did a year and a half in Germany, in back to movements, back to war movements, but as one British corps, which was part of BAOR, so lower down the scale. And then at the end of the time, I could have stayed in the British Army. They were sort of saying, if you'll sign on again, we'll send you on an officer training course. A short service commission, it's called. It's not the full Sandhurst thing. But the Labour government was just coming in, and it looked like they were going to cut back the defence and everything. I could have gone to Australia, Canada, or South Africa and held my rank and gone into the army. South Africa, my wife would have loved to gone to Australia. She didn't want to come back here to Ireland. South Africa, I knew I couldn't stand. I was against apartheid, and it was rampant in those days. This would have been 67. Australia had gone in with America and was sending troops to Vietnam. And I reckon that if I went as a new British corporal going over there, I'd get sent to Vietnam quicker than a local guy would. And I was damned if I was going to, after getting away with not hearing a shot for 9 years, to go and to get into a war which I definitely didn't agree with. And Canada was too cold and bleak for my liking. So I decided to come home.
And did you have any idea what you were going to do, or what did you do when you came?
Well, the British Army gives you pre-release courses. And you could have trained as a tradesman and that, but I can't put a nail in straight. So one of their release courses was to be a sort of a manager in Securico. And I applied for that. And I did a month's training in London, which in actual fact turned out to be a cheap way of Securico getting people to run their cash carrying and such like thing in London. But then I came back, and while they were a bit against me coming into the Dublin branch, you know, being sort of foisted in from outside, I eventually became joined Securico.
And this was at the end of the 1960s, was it? Just somewhere in the middle of the 1960s.
67. 67,
yeah.
I was in Securico from about 67 to 70. I was there for the first big IRA attack, a raid.
Were you
on Aer Lingus?
You weren't there, were you?
I was there.
Yeah.
Deputy branch manager the day it happened.
Well, tell me.
I wasn't out on it.
Yeah, but tell me exactly when you were deputy branch manager in
Securico was a very, it was run by one man from London, Keith Erskine. And every Tuesday night, you sat around a boardroom table like this in your branch office and sat by a phone till it rang. And that was London ringing you. And you reported, and you had to have new contracts for all your different divisions. And at the end of it, the guy in London, because I'd done it, that end of it when I was over in London train, held up the phone. And Erskine would be walking around and he'd say, who's, and he'd say, Stubblin, sir. How are they? And, oh, they've got Drexler. So, who am I speaking to? And you tell him, very good. You did well. Take 50.
And what did you mean by take 50?
He'd be giving you £50 a week, a year extra.
Right.
And your increases went up. And yeah. I mean, I joined Securicorp at 850 a year.
In 1967, but that wasn't too bad.
No. And I remember going home to my wife, delighted. I think we went out for a meal together. The first time I hit £1,000 a year, that we had £20 a week coming in. It was on, you know, that was before tax.
Yeah. During those years, the robbery that took place in Shannon, was it?
No, in Dublin Airport.
Or in Dublin Airport, yeah. Talk me through that.
Well, what happened was we used to, on a Thursday and Friday, we did cash runs to businesses all over Dublin, delivering their wages. And in some cases, we picked up the money on Thursday night. We had a vault in Drumconda Road, just down from the Cat and Cage. And that was where Securicorp was based, in an ordinary house, but they'd built a vault into it. Like a bank vault with gates and combinations and everything. And the money went in there for the Aer Lingus pay office. And you weren't supposed to have more than £10,000 in any one bag. And I think it was three or four. It was 40,000 or 30,000. I can't remember now which. And then the next morning, they were taken out of the vault and put into an armoured car and up to the airport. Now, the pay office was on the top floor of a four-storey building at the airport, just outside the arrivals terminal. And when the guys were, well, they were doing it wrong because it was so high and everything. They were taking two cases at a time. And they came up to them and sprayed them with ammonia and grabbed two cases off them.
It was a very simple robbery, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was no guns, but the guy was nearly very bad because when he saw them coming at him, he opened his mouth to yell and the spray went into his mouth and it clogged up his throat and he nearly died. Only they got to him. And they eventually caught two of them. Yeah, they never caught the main people, but they caught two of them. And
What year was that? I think it was 1970. Yeah. And you remain on how did that affect you then?
Well, it affected me that I got fired three times that day by Erskine. It so happened that the branch manager and the senior salesman were over at a meeting in London. That's how I was in charge. And I'd signed the money in and signed it out the next morning. And by what I've heard since is that I got fired because I was in charge and we'd lost money. First time we'd lost that much money in Ireland. It was the first big robbery in Ireland. And then all the press got onto it. And there was a lot of talk about the guy that was badly injured. And the press was very much on Securicorp's side initially, the Herald and the Mail and that, and the evening papers. And it was pointed out to Erskine that it would be very bad publicity if they got that the manager or the man in charge had been sacked when it was no fault of his. He wasn't on the truck. You know, it was just because he was in charge. And the idea was I was being sacked because I hadn't trained them well enough that they didn't go up one at a time, you know, one bag at a time. And so it was rescinded. I didn't get sacked. But I remember meeting senior detectives for the first time in the Garda Síochána. And like everybody else, we hadn't got a great opinion of the Garda Síochána. But I remember this guy coming in, and I mean, they really grilled us because it was thought that it was an inside job. And the fact that I'd signed the money in and out put the suspicion on me that I'd handled it both ways, in the night before and out the day, next morning. And by God, I got to respect those police.
How did the, you said, the, well, it was the IRA that... when they were planning the operation, now looking back at it, do you think they in any way approached you? Do you remember anything about
anybody? Nobody ever approached me personally, and I don't think anybody did approach staff. I think it was just a case. We were always caught when we were delivering money that the company employing us had to take on security because their insurance told them that you have to have security. It's the same today. But they wouldn't go with our rules and regulations. They wanted the money delivered at 9 o'clock every Friday morning. It had to be at that time. And so therefore you could sit outside the offices and time the van going in by watching the vans going in. And because they were up on the fourth floor, their wages office was, all the lads did the same thing, took two bags in at a time. So again, it was bad systems.
Now, this just lasted, it just lasted 2 more years afterwards?
Yeah, after that, I was working 70 hours a week. I mean, you worked and for no overtime. And I mean, it was great times in it. We did great things and great shows out, you know, and that sort of thing, and met great people. But it was just heavy going. And so I decided, I was keeping looking out in the papers. I made up my mind. And it was too unstable. I mean, I knew at any time Erskine could fire me just because I hadn't reached a target or something like that. So there was no stability in it. And I looked out for a job, and a job came up for a security and transport manager in Auto Zero, which refrigerated cold storage. And I applied for it and got it and moved to them.
And this was totally different work again.
Yeah, but yeah. Then there was a guy opened up here. Again, you're talking about the 1970s, where we were still in recession. Things weren't happening, but they were beginning to happen. And a guy opened a company called Careers Register.
Where?
In Dublin. And
whereabouts in Dublin?
I forget where his address was, somewhere in an office downtown. And his idea was to start, it was a recruitment agency. But his idea was he got people to apply to him, and he did your resume and he looked at it, and then he applied for jobs that you might never apply for. And it turned out that he was an ex-British officer, and I got on well with him. I applied, went to him. Not because I was dissatisfied with my job, but just that I felt, you know, I'd like to see, could I get on a bit better? And don't forget, when I went to the British Army, I'd gone in with a primary cert, but I got my O-levels and A-levels in the British Army, because that was the great thing about the British Army. They did things for you. And So I went down to him, and he was, as I say, he was an ex-army officer, British Army officer. And he took all my details and said he'd get in contact. And then a couple of weeks later, I forget when, he rang me back and he said, look, I'm going to put you in for distribution manager jobs. I said, I've never done management. And he said, yes, you have. He said, what did you do in the British Army? And I said, movement control. And he said, that's distribution. And he says, what have you been doing in Secure Corps? And I said, night patrols, cash and carry. He says, that's distribution in another way. You planned it. Because I was there at a time when Secure Corps was growing. Mm-hmm. So we had to plan new routes and things like that. And he then said to me, right, sometime later, I want you to apply for a job in Warner Lambert as distribution manager. And I applied and got it. And I had to open a new warehouse, had to build in. Well, the warehouse was built, you know, the four walls. And I think there was a space cut off for an office, but there was no racking, no nothing else in it. And I was given 6 weeks to get that warehouse ready to run as a distribution centre.
Now, it was a distribution centre for what? What exactly?
Pharmaceuticals and hair colourants. And they did palm olive. They did Warner Lambert tablets.
But all pharmacy material.
Yeah. Yes.
Which in a way was kind of dangerous too, you know, with drugs and...
That. All different types of drugs.
So it had to be secure
and everything like that. Yeah. And my father had, from the time my mother died, from before the time, he'd been working for a firm called Johnston Brothers up in Clonard Road in Kimmage, who were a distribution, warehousing and distribution for people like McVitie's Biscuits and Andrew's Liver Salts, that company. And I was friend, the boys of that family, it was a Quaker family, the Johnstons, used to come out to our house in Palmerston, and we kept a boat for them and went fishing. And I got to know the boys. Now, they were, like myself, growing up. They were running the company. So I ran one of them and said, look, I've got this job. Any chance I could come up and go through your warehouse and just get an idea of how a warehouse is done? Because they did all different things like I was going to do. And of course, Warner Lambert had a warehouse down on Pottery Road in Black Rock, in Dean's Grange. So, I mean, I could see what they had before.
And had you the finance to do this? Now, it was given to you. So you had a blank check to spend.
Well, not a blank check. I had to work to budgets.
Yeah. All right. Yes. Yeah,
very much. And anyway, between the two, I got the idea and put in the thing. And over a bank holiday weekend, on the Friday night, we closed. I think it was Easter, so maybe on the third. I can't remember which. On the Friday night, we closed the warehouse in Pottery Road, moved it over the weekend, and started distribution on the Tuesday morning from Northwall, Castle Forbes Road.
Well, do you think it was because of the pressure of trying to get it open within that 6 months, or was it
6 weeks?
Or 6 weeks? Sorry, yeah. That in that 6 weeks.
I'd never done it before.
Yeah, again, it's probably your training and your background in military and
And then I got for the next 12 years about. I moved firms every 3 years. I got bored. When everything was running right, I got bored.
And how many other jobs were you in?
I finished working here in the library.
When did you join the library? Hold on now. First, we backtrack. So we're in 1976, isn't it, when you took on the job of distribution?
1970, just after, about 71, 72. And I went to Warner Lambert. I then got headhunted to a guy by the name of Jimmy Carroll, who, again, was doing the distribution service for Aaron Foods. And Jimmy was a a millionaire. I called him to his face. He's a knacker millionaire. And he was into all sorts of things, and it was dangerous working for him.
Why?
He wouldn't let you, he would let you pick your own staff, but then there was a parish, we worked off John Rogerson's quay in the North Wall, and the local parish priest coming up to him and say, "Ah, Jimmy, I've got two lads, they're just out of jail, and you know, they're drug addicts, but they're on the methadone now, would you take them on?" We had the most weird characters, and he'd take them on.
Why? Because it was he helping them out, or was it
helping
was
them
cheap?
Out. No, helping them out.
Really? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so then, he was a good man.
He was a good man, that. But he didn't drink. He had clatter of kids. But it was just queer. I mean, when I went into him, and I forget what I was getting in Warren Alarm, it was up about 3,000 a year or something. And he says to me, "And how much are you paying that in tax?" And of course, in those days, you're paying 66%. In tax, you know, and I'm not giving you that. I'm not giving it to the taxman. I'll give you 2,000, and you can draw 2,000 in expenses per month. And that's what he did. You know, you weren't paying tax.
To play the black market, yeah. So in order to pay your salary.
So again, that was I enjoyed it in a way. I mean, the day I arrived to start, I'd been employed to run a food distribution centre, which is basically what I'd been doing, right? The day I arrived, I think there was there was a strike or something happened, but in the sugar factories. And Jimmy had got the contract, a 10,000 ton ship had come into Dublin Port full of sugar. And had to be brought down to the sugar factories in Mallow.
Yeah.
And Jimmy had got the contract to do it. Now, he had no trucks of his own.
Yeah, yeah.
And the day I walked into his office, he said, "Oh, you're not starting here, Joe. Here, I bought you this." And a big donkey jacket gave me. Down onto the side of the docks and organised the truckloads. And blokes were coming up from the country and saying, "I hear there's a job going. I've got 340 foots here. Have you? Oh, yes, line up there." And like, you wouldn't know them from Adam. I mean, we lost one load because guy went home for the weekend with the sugar on board and didn't come back till the Monday. And we couldn't find him anywhere. And I mean, but that was Jimmy.
And is it for those reasons that you left that company?
Well, I then went to ADM Londis and to open up a new warehouse down in Johnstown. And I did that. But again, there was I can take management if it's fair. But if it's not fair, I can't take it. And the ADM Londis was just growing at the time. There was this one-man operation. I should have known better. I'd been through one-man operation. And this was another one. And he'd come down to the warehouses. And the lads used to call it in the warehouse, he's coming down to do his stations at the cross. And he'd walk around the warehouse. And he'd find a number of things, no matter how good it was. He'd find a number of faults and read you the riot act in front of everybody. And just after that, after I think I was only there 6 months, maybe a year, a job appeared in the paper, and it was from Dad's old factory, Johnston Brothers, Clonard Road, looking for a distribution manager. And I applied and got it. And in actual fact, Terry told me afterwards he'd put it in, being fairly certain. I haven't heard from Dad. Dad was finished, had retired by then. But haven't heard from Dad that I wasn't happy where I was. And I joined them. And I would have stayed them forever. I should have stayed with them. And I got headhunted by Fiat, and the pay increase and the increases were just so ridiculous. I couldn't refuse it. And I got in there and...
With who? With Fiat?
Fiat, distribution manager for Fiat, moving cars this time. But as I said, one of the consumer magazines interviewed me when I got the Fiat job. And they, as I pointed out to them, there's no, once you're distribution, there's no difference what you're moving. You know,
it could be anything.
You've got to quality control, yeah. Safety, and they're all the same. And I moved to them then and was there until I was 50, the year I was 50. And part of my job there was to reorganize their distribution service and find out an outside contractor to move their trucks. Because again, they were doing what I'd done with Jimmy Carroll. They were hiring in from all over, or the garages would send down trucks to pick up the cars. And I helped set up NVD Transport, an outside firm. But basically, and I knew it from the time I joined that I was doing away with my own job. I started there with over 30 people working under me and ended up and with 700 working in Fiat, because they were manufacturing cars then or assembling them. And when I left, there was only 39 people left in the whole company.
They were going down.
They computerized.
And computers were taking over. So we were going into the computer world, really.
Yeah. And then I was made redundant from there, and nobody had employed me. I was too qualified, too experienced, and too well paid.
Is that where it ended?
Yeah, that's where it ended. I went back to security, but just as an ordinary security guard, and I ended up for 9 years, I think, on the beer check in Guinness's, checking out the beer in Guinness's, and really enjoyed that. And then I was getting more and more into local history, and there was a crowd in Clondalkin setting up the Clondalkin Heritage Group, and they asked me to come in as manager and to run that group, to make it, to get money in. They were setting up a FOSS desktop printing scheme as well. Now, I wasn't involved in that. We were also publishing bits and pieces on local history. But my pay came from half from the Heritage Group and half from FOSS.
And so this gave you a new outlook, really,
didn't it? Well,
it
gave me what I always wanted, was to be in local history and work in that type of thing, do that.
And how many years are you doing that now?
Well, or? I didn't. With 21, 12 weeks, I started in September of 99. And between Christmas and New Year, I was in Paris and I collapsed. And, well, I'd known for about 6 months before that I was a diabetic, and I'd ignored it. And I collapsed with diabetes. And when I got home, I was in Tallaghir for 2 weeks. And then I was, had a very nasty thing happen to me in Tallaghir that 2 weeks. During the summer before this, the summer of 99, I'd gone to New York. I don't know whether you've ever been in New York, but it might be a great city, but they've the filthiest toilets you've ever come across. And when I came back, I was peeing through broken glass, and I thought I'd picked up, a sex-orientated disease. And I suppose I was too embarrassed to go and tell anybody, although I hadn't done anything to get it. What happened was, there was so much sugar in my blood, I got thrush in my foreskin, and I had to be circumcised at 60, which wasn't pleasant. And then when I came out of the Tallaghir, they told me I'd have to take a month off work to get back into full health. And FOSS wouldn't pay me, and I had a row with the Heritage Trust because I felt they didn't back me. And then I came up here one day to see Georgina, who was the librarian here at the time. And I'd collected postcards. I'd an archive of stuff. And so I wrote to the head librarian here, the county librarian. and asked him, would he be interested in copying? They just started the local studies section here. And then I went to Georgina and said, if they did this, could you employ me? I mean, I was 60 and I thought I'd never work again. And could you employ me as a consultant to write up the notes with the postcards and all the other photographs I had? And as I was leaving her office that day, she said, Joe, would you be interested in a porter's job here in the county council? She said, there's applications got to be in tomorrow. I'll give you one. And when I got home, the phone rang and she got on. She said, Joe, I found out they're also going for library attendance, which is a porter in the library. She said, can you get that photocopied and do two of them and get them back to me? I'll sponsor you. And I had an interview the next Tuesday. The next Thursday I was called in to start porter and library attendant.
And that's what you're doing presently as well?
No, I'm retired now. No. And I did that basically, ending up in the new library in Lucan for 4 years until I was 66.
Oh, it was a good long stretch, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it worked out grand because I got a small pension out of it and I got nothing out of the federal security company I've been with in Guinness's.
So can I ask you, Joe, I mean, what an interesting life. You've gone through all the different careers that you had. I think you must have had more careers than anybody I know.
Because in other times, like when I was in Secure Corps, when I went to Ottawa Zero, we had my wife's uncle had helped us buy a small house in Carlingford Road. And he'd lent us the money and we were paying him back practically interest free. We were paying it into a building society account and he was going to accept that as the interest on it. Mm-hmm. And we moved out here to Clondalkin, which at that time seemed an awful amount of money. And I went in and did 9 to 5 in Auto Zero and then did for 3 months before I got the job in Warner Lambert. I went into the telephone exchange in Dublin, the telephone exchange operator at night till 11 o'clock each night.
So there's a lot behind you. There's an awful lot of different work. Can I ask you two things? What was, and you have to think about this now, what was the best moment of your life, and what was the lowest moment in your life? Go with the highest first.
Well, I can give you the lowest easier. My younger brother committed suicide 3 years ago. And I'd been with him two nights before and thought he was okay. And that gets me, it's getting me now.
Yeah, and that's the lowest. From nothing. Depression or anything?
Nothing. No? His girlfriend had just left. And he was coming up to 60 and he was a fabulous guy, terrific comedian. Had become the first, as he said, non-millionaire president of the Vintage Car Association, was chairman and founder of the Morris Minor Club of Ireland, and was a great guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Just got him. And
switching to the highest moment.
Highest? I don't. Very hard to think of peaks. I mean, there was lots of little ones all along the way. I suppose being published for the first time. I'd set myself out 3 things to do in my life. Because I left school at primary level, I wanted to get a degree. I was always interested in politics, so I wanted to run in an election. And I wanted to write a book and publish it. I ran as a county councillor for Fianna Fáil in 79. Didn't get in, but I didn't expect to get in. But I did. I got selected, and that was my ambition. I got two books and a couple of pamphlets published.
What were the titles?
I did a walk through the past, a tourist trail of Clondalkin in the late 80s. And then I did Clondalkin postcards, where I used my postcard collection to show the history of Clondalkin, the book there. And then 2 years ago, I wrote St. Mocco and the Round Tower, which is the story of the saint that founded the monastery in Clondalkin, and the Round Tower and my thoughts about it.
So there was politics, there was publishing, and what were the other things in your life that you said?
The other thing I wanted was a degree. I went to Maynooth and got a certificate in local history, a diploma in local history. And I started to do a BA, and I passed 11 modules when I crashed out with diabetes. And then I'd been separated. I'd been with another lady for 18 years, and within a couple of years of that, 6 years ago, she told me to take a walk. And so I was dependent on the two incomes coming into a house to allow me the money to do a part-time course. And I wasn't up to it, because diabetes affects you mentally. And while I think I'm fully recovered now, then for about a year afterwards, I was not working to full mental capacity.
But you almost achieved your ambitions, really.
I got to university.
Yes.
Put it that way.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, Joe Williams, it's been a long story, but a fascinating story. And thank you very much for telling it to me. Thank you.
Not at all. It was helpful in a way, because I'm trying to write it now myself.